Welcome to season 4 of the Brave Writer podcast, A Brave Writer's Life in Brief. I'm Julie Bogart, your host. This season, we are releasing via audio our most popular YouTube broadcasts. We're so excited that you can now listen to these on audio while you're running, driving in the car, or folding laundry. We will also sprinkle throughout this season original content, interviews with people I think are compelling to listen to. If you get a chance, please help us out by leaving a review at iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen to Brave Writers podcast. We really appreciate it. It helps us get the word out, and it also gratifies all the people behind the scenes who work so hard to bring these to you for free. And now, let's get going with this episode. Good morning. Good morning. So today's topic is family dynamics. Today we're going to talk a little bit about roles, the roles people play in their families. And the reason this topic I think is really valuable is that sometimes the roles we take in our family are involuntary. We are not consciously choosing our roles. Sometimes we participate in a family dynamic as a way of coping, as a way of living in a system. Things get more and more rigid and tighter, the less healthy the family is. So one thing to notice in a family is how fluid are the roles. Is it possible sometimes for a child to fulfill a different role? Can your high achiever be irresponsible? Can your irresponsible child surprise you and be a high achiever? Can one parent completely do the other parent's jobs and be seen as simply contributing to the whole? Or does that participation suddenly look like a rebuke, like doing what the other person didn't get done, or usurping somebody's domain? Or is there fluidity in partnership? Family roles, the roles we play in our families, are often pleasurable. You know, when you're a young child, you don't want to be in charge of the bank balance for the family and budgeting. We get to be, as young children, just go along to get along, eat the food that's provided, play with the toys bought for me, fill my day with activities my parents approve of. There's a certain liberation to being 5, 6, 7, and 8. But there are limits to that child's responsibility. There's limits to that child's power. The power and responsibility axis are what create roles in families. So I want you to think about that for a moment. The person with the most power also has the greatest responsibility. The person with the least power has the least responsibility. So a newborn baby, not much responsibility. They just show up. They cry, they sleep, they eat, they poop. That's what they do. And we aren't expecting them to have a good attitude about it. You know, even when they're crying and we feel distressed, our goal is to heal and comfort the distress. We aren't thinking to ourselves, what a bad attitude. That 6-week-old better get it together. And parents who have that attitude sometimes find themselves in a very hostile relationship with their youngest children. I remember reading about a family where the parent actually used alcohol to soothe the baby who was crying. Literally giving the baby shots of whiskey to try and drug it to make it sleep. That's a dysfunctional relationship. That's a parent using their power and responsibility abusively. So what we're talking about is when you have power, you have to be responsible. When you don't have power, you are less responsible. So as we're looking then at how our families evolve into a healthy organism, we want to think about what level of power each member has. That's how we define the roles. We don't define the roles through the constructs of tradition or history or social location. We want roles to simply be adopted because there's freedom to choose to live within that role. A great case in point would be what most of you women are doing as stay-at-home moms. Now, I know a lot of you who are home educators have part-time gigs or work full-time outside the home. And so I'm not directly addressing you in this next comment, but I want you to understand that the larger context is also true of you. For those of you who've chosen to stay home and not be employed outside of the home, and who are not earning a paycheck for home educating or some other source of income, you are flying in the face of the current moment, which is that women have the freedom now to go into the workplace and earn money, not quite on the same level as men. We're still only making 72 cents on the dollar, but we at least can choose that for ourselves. And during the 1970s in particular, there was a whole generation of children who were put in daycare to make that possible. And we owe those women a debt, even if we have chosen against them. Here's why. They expanded the categories of choice for us. And they made it possible for us to choose a role, not be stifled by a role. They made it possible for us to determine, I want to stay home, not I'm expected to stay home. And so what we have today in this traditional model of family that many of us have adopted as home educators is we've chosen the role that looks fairly traditional. We live in a house, we make the meals, we manage, you know, the housekeeping. Now we've added school teacher to that role. We've said, I'm going to be responsible for the education of our children. And everything about that looks very traditionally, classically female. It almost, to some people, looks disempowering. And I know you know, because your friends who work outside the home sometimes look at what you're doing as somehow deficient or demeaning. The way that you keep yourself from being rigidly tied to a role is to always recognize that you are choosing, that no one assigned it to you. It is not because you had no other option. It is because you chose it. At the point that you feel that the role you're in no longer serves you, or if you start to feel hemmed in by it, that means you're losing your choices. The reason I'm spending so much time on this part of this discussion is this. You will be the most effective home educator, stay-at-home mom you can be if you know it's a choice. Choice creates space and freedom. You've seen it with your children. When you say to a child, well, we can either go to the park or the zoo, that's different than we have to go to the park. Suddenly there's a little breathing room. There's a little bit of, you get hungry. You don't just go make yourself a meal. There isn't like a box labeled lunch for Julie, and I just go in and take out that box and someone else has provided it for me. That happens at hospitals, right? When I've just come out of surgery, the nurse brings me what I'm going to drink, what I'm going to eat. I have very little choice over that. And a lot of it is, you know, based on my current condition. The power and the responsibility fall on the hospital to take care of me. And I can just let go and be a patient, correct? That role is a role that I really, really enjoy. But at the point that I'm healthy, that's no longer an enjoyable role. I don't want someone to take away all my choices and tell me what I have to do and create for me conditions that prescribe how I feed myself. So today when I'm hungry, what do? I wander around the kitchen. Don't you do this? And I open the refrigerator and I kind of look at the food. It's not like I don't know what's in there, but I literally have to look at it again. And I go, oh, grapes. Do I feel like something juicy and cold? Kind of not. I kind of want something salty. And I look around and the refrigerator just doesn't have a lot of salty things. So then I close it. And then I walk over to the cabinets and I open up the pantry. I like Triscuits. Well, that's really salty, but it's kind of crunchy. I want Triscuits. Maybe you want Cheez-Its. They're not quite so crunchy and so roughage oriented. But gosh, if I eat Cheez-Its, will I want Cheez-Its? Is that just like a waste of calories? And then I just start foraging. Oh, I'll eat almonds. You've done this, right? And then you eat almonds because you feel good about yourself. They're salty and they're healthy and you're going to eat almonds. But you know what? Secretly, you really wanted those Cheez-Its. And like an hour later, you eat the whole box. Like, doesn't that happen? That's what freedom looks like. I have the power and responsibility to think about my choices and make good ones or not good ones. And then an hour after the Cheez-It binge, I'll probably make a smoothie with spinach in it because I know for me, health looks like fruits and vegetables blended in a drink. When you are on your own completely, you make those decisions for yourself. So when we're talking about family roles, the best way for you to embrace the countercultural choice of staying at home with your children and being their educator is to recognize that you're making it as a choice. It wasn't consigned to you. It was the power of women's liberation that enabled you to make that as a choice, to not have it be your full script. So I want you to start there. Just feel the full power of that. Does everyone get it? You are at home because you chose it. You foraged around all the various, you know, styles of womanhood. You even maybe tried some on. You might have worked for a little while. You might have collaborated a little. Some of you are choosing right now to work and stay home. You have combined roles. You're nursing at night, you're homeschooling in the morning, and you're sleeping in the afternoon. Some of you have side gigs, a blog, you're selling stuff on Etsy. These are choices. And each time you make a choice, there's a certain level of empowerment and responsibility that comes with it. I'm harping on this because when we look at our children and we look at our spouses, we sometimes forget how much of a choice we've made. And we've also sometimes not analyzed our own choices. Maybe we didn't choose. It's possible you're listening to me right now, and the only reason you're homeschooling is because someone told you you should, and you feel guilty. You have ideological or religious reasons, or a spouse that's requiring it, or a mother who homeschooled you, and you feel guilty like you'd invalidate her by putting your kids in school. These are not full choices. They are the little bit of dysfunction around the choice. And that's what I want us to start to pay attention to, because that's exactly how it feels for our kids. So here's what I want us to consider as we're looking at roles in family. How do we facilitate the greatest freedom to choose at the various levels of power that our kids have? A newborn has no choices. They are literally dependent on your goodwill for survival. They would die if you don't attend to them. So your philosophy of parenting determines everything about that newborn. That newborn can't say, well, I don't really like how you're parenting me right now. They just have to wait for the breast or the bottle. And you decide. That baby has no more will to exert than your thumbnail. You literally, that baby can't do anything for itself. It can make its needs known in the ways that it has available through crying or squirming or, you know, that's about it. So that baby has no responsibility, but also no power. As you move forward in time, what you discover is your children start to take initiative. They start to forage through the refrigerator and pantry of options. Does it feel good to be a bully? Does it feel good to be passive and helpless? Does it feel good to take initiative? Does it feel good to be directed? Does it feel good to work on things really diligently and then have a break? Or does it feel great to have only breaks and never work diligently? These are all choices about how to be in the world. And your kids are making them unconsciously, moment by moment, every day. And part of what you're doing as this stay-at-home parent who's decided to devote themselves to the well-being and educational growth of your children is you are giving input, you are limiting and expanding the choices that your children have for the roles that they take in their family. And here's the catch. If you get a fixed view of who your children are, each one individually, you limit their growth. They can't grow if they only get to show up in one way. What you want to look for is the foraging through the pantry, the hunting through the refrigerator for options, trying the grapes and realizing they didn't want them, trying total freedom and realizing it didn't work, exploring what it feels like to work on a subject in sort of an incremental, systematic way over a period of time to see how that feels. So often, the way we organize our homeschools is we are like, well, she's a kinesthetic learner. He's an auditory learner. I'm just going to focus on that for each of them. Or, well, I know she's a perfectionist. She really needs structure. But do we know that? Has that been a script you've laid over the top of your child? Is that how you are and you hope your child will be? Or is that also a way for you to criticize your child to keep the blame off of yourself? Rigid roles come from dysfunction. Flexibility supports health. And flexibility is just scary. It feels a little out of control. It feels a little bit like we don't have a say. But weirdly, we have more of a say when there's flexibility, because what we're saying is, there are so many options. And I, as your mother, am powerful enough, responsible enough, and big enough to create space for the multitudes that live inside of you. You don't have to be the, you know, scapegoat of the family or the class clown of the family. It's okay for you to show up as serious. I remember just recently talking with my mother, and I'm sure Jacob wouldn't mind me sharing this. He's like our high achiever kid. He's the one who's gotten all the scholarships, and he's at Columbia Law, and he's, you know, done so much that's admirable from an academic point of view. But he also loses stuff, a shoe, coats, iPads, you know, he's lost stuff. And there was this notion that because he was a high achiever, those things weren't happening. Like, people literally exclude that from their description of who Jacob is. And I remember saying at one point to my mom, this is also who he is. And we want to include that. It's really toxic to say things like, he would never, or she's not like that. Because we're all a mixture of things. And it's actually almost reassuring, isn't it, that your highest achieving kid can't keep track of his own pair of shoes? Because then you start to realize, well, if he can't keep track of his shoes and I'm kind of a disaster with keeping track of things, I could also, though, still be in a high achiever person. There isn't one template that creates success. It's managing all the facets of who we are. So if you have a child in your family right now who looks traditionally non-academic, do we just say, well, he's not really academic, he's never going to go to college, and then we just steer him away from college? Or do we keep the door open, space for that child's imagination to open at any time?
You're listening to the Brave Writer Podcast. Today, I want to tell you about Instagram. It turns out Instagram is my favorite social media playground. I love to share photos of my family, inspirational photos about homeschooling and writing, and sometimes I even share your photos with our community. My goal for my Instagram account is to provide you with inspiration, a belief that you will get there someday, that you're doing the right things to bring about a quality education for your family. And I also like to share writing advice. If you are looking for a place where you can hang out and experience a lot of support, join me at Julie Brave Writer. That's my account, at Julie Brave Writer. I also like to share photos from your poetry tea times at my other Instagram account, at Poetry Tea Time. Please come follow along. If you want me to see what you're sharing on Instagram, use the hashtag Brave Writer Lifestyle, or simply tag me in your photos. I love to comment, send hearts, smiley faces, the whole nine yards. So let's get this thing going. And now let's return to today's podcast.
I remember very distinctly telling my friends when I was in high school and college that if I got married, I did not want to have a big fancy wedding and I didn't want to wear a long dress. Now, the reason, the secret to me reason that no one knew is I was afraid I wouldn't get married, that there was no man who would really want me. And so I had this weird idea that I'd just have to marry for friendship, not for love. And that would not be a legitimate reason to wear a long dress. This was my weird psychology at 18 and 20. And to be truthful, I don't think I even understood the depth of that connection until years later in therapy. So here's what happened. When I went shopping for a wedding dress with my mother, she had heard me rail against traditional weddings for all those years in high school and college. And the first dress I tried on wasn't even a wedding dress. It was a white Laura Ashley dress that just went over the knees, big puffy sleeves. You know, it was the 1980s. And I tried it on, first dress. And my mom said, oh, look at that. The very first dress you try on is exactly the one that you wanted. We don't even have to go shopping now. And in my heart of hearts, I thought as I was trying it on, shoot, I should have found this dress last. I mean, don't girls get to try on a lot of dresses before they pick one? And it took all my courage to say to my mother, could I just try on one more dress in this store? And my mom said, of course. So I went and found a long white dress that looked very different than the one I had just tried on. And my mom, thinking she was honoring who I said I wanted to be, said, oh yeah, I like the other one. It really matches what you say you wanted. I really think the other dress, but here's what's crazy. When I had on the long dress, I suddenly felt like I was getting married. But I didn't have the heart to say it because I felt like I'd be a fraud. So I didn't shop for any more dresses. I didn't go to a single other shop. I never set foot in a true bridal shop. I didn't try on 20 dresses. I didn't drink champagne in the dressing rooms. I bought the first dress. And then, you know, 5 years later in therapy, I was having a breakdown. And I actually went wedding dress shopping. I took off my wedding ring and I went to a whole bunch of stores and I tried on all these really cool dresses. One was very sexy and slinky. And I stood there with my maid of honor. Both of us had been married for years. And I looked in the mirror and I got tears in my eyes. And I said to her, I could have pulled this off. And she said, of course you could. Of course you could. It was a revelation that I had locked myself into a role to self-protect. That's what a role is. A role sometimes is just a way of hiding because you're afraid to risk some unknown aspect of yourself, some part of you that you're afraid will get shot down or the person will tell you, well, that's not who you really are. And the problem is we believe our children. We believe it when they say things to us because we want to build a good relationship. My mom was doing what she thought was the right thing. I don't blame her at all. She was honoring everything I had ever said. And to be fair, the dress I bought was beautiful. I did enjoy wearing it that day. But there was a whole other part of my identity as a young woman that I didn't know I was eligible to explore. Does that make sense? Liam, my fourth child, who's dysgraphic, added a year to junior high because he was not ready for high school. I just said to him, you know what? Why are we in a hurry? We're going to do 4 years of junior high instead of three. What did he care? He was at home. So we did. He didn't start freshman in high school until a full year after he should have, quote unquote. When he got done with high school, he took an additional year off before he went off to college. He didn't like traditional high school. He did some of it at our local high school. He got it done in 2.5 years because he hated it. He didn't get good grades. We even had meetings, you know, with teachers about his performance. And then he went off finally to the right school for him, considered one of the hardest schools to go to. And I worried he'd flounder. No, he thrived. This is my kid who had the lowest evidence for academic aptitude. And just 2 days ago, he told me, I'm looking at PhD programs. What? Are you sure? I don't know that he'll do one, but he's going to be a senior. And that's where his brain went. That was interesting to me. And you know, part of why he's even open to it is he just spent a week with one of his cousins who is in a PhD program. And he realized, well, I can keep up with this guy. Everything he's studying is what I'm studying right now. There was a certain new vision of self that emerged. It would really be weird if I came back and said, oh, but you're not really academic material. I mean, are you sure you want to go to a traditional university? You've really never been interested in that. But that's what we do. It's how we jam our children into roles. We tell them who they are to them. And because they are just slowly forming their identities, they start to believe us. You know, and if you describe your kids in front of other people, holy smokes, are you just reinforcing those roles? You know, if you say, well, she's not really in, he's this. I can't tell you how many homeschool conventions I've been to where a parent in front of her children describes her kids to me in not kind terms. You know, he's really a struggling learner, hates, you know, writing, is just finds it very difficult to do any assignments right in front of him, which is a judgment. It's not even a description. What if she brought her son to me and said, here's my son. He's really curious about writing. I'm excited for him to learn to love it. I've not been successful yet in that endeavor, but I know that under the right conditions, he would blossom. Can you help me help him blossom and see writing in a new way? That would be totally different. That opens the door for that child to reimagine his relationship to writing. Roles are all about fitting in. And as homeschoolers, we've already proven we don't care about that. Otherwise, you'd be in the school system. You don't want to fit in. You're hoping to do something new and different. So help your kids recognize that the opportunity for difference exists. When Noah, my oldest, was going to college, he went to University of Cincinnati, he started out as a linguistics major and really hated the general education in college. And so at some point, he said to me, Mom, I'm not going to make it. I can't do the general ed. And I said, well, are you liking your linguistics classes? And he said, yes. I said, all right, do your major and then quit. It's exactly what he did. Is he in the linguistics field? No. Did we pay for school that didn't result in a degree? Yes. Oh, so is the only goal of college to get a degree? One of my favorite stories was Steve Jobs, who quit college and then started auditing the calligraphy class. That class, calligraphy, is what enabled the Insight to have a variety of fonts available on a computer screen. It's what created the documents that had fonts, not just green typeface across a black background, which is how all computers were in the early 80s. Think about that. He left school to take a calligraphy class, and it catalyzed a whole different train of thinking. For Noah, he's in computer programming and languages. Linguistics is related. The logic of language is all related. But even if it wasn't, he learned all kinds of things about himself and about education and about language and what it means to be an academic and how to think through arguments and how to read a variety of perspectives and reconcile those or not. There's value there. Had I been only about colleges for kids who are college ready, he wouldn't have taken those classes. So I ask you, is that a waste? Did I need to focus on what I saw and only reward that which fits the role of what I assumed was valuable? And it's been hard for me. Noah made a really interesting observation, one that I've taken to heart. He said, you know, Mom, you've always said that college isn't the only way to a good degree. And you've always said that we could write however we wanted. But you and Dad both have master's degrees. You and Dad have both taught at college. You and Dad are both professional writers. And without saying a word, that exerts pressure. Well, absolutely true. And to be conscious of the pressure that is exerted in your family is how you create a healthy environment for your kids. You can't erase who you are, or even the invisible expectations that just come through your enthusiasms, but you can be conscious of it. You can subvert your children's expectations. They wake up, they know it's Saturday morning and chores, but it's a gorgeous day, and you want them to know that it's okay to play and not get chores done all the time, and you say, chores are canceled, we're going on a hike. I've made really good food. All you have to do is put on your tennis shoes, go. That's how you create space for change, difference, new vision of self. If you want your kids to both work hard and play hard, you have to make room for playing hard, and it has to take away from working hard. If you want your playful children to have an opportunity to feel the satisfaction of working hard, then you've got to think about ways that make working hard an appealing aspiration. You can't get there just through shame and blame and casting these, you know, prophecies of doom, which we've all done, me included. Part of how we grow in our families is to create space for kids who are in roles to change. One of the questions that I sometimes get is about sibling rivalry. So you have a child who's like a high achiever and then another child who's a quote unquote not so high achiever. I would like to suggest a revolutionary thought. We're all high achievers when it comes to what we're interested in. Even if what we're interested in is ultra relaxation, right? I mean, the kid who is on the computer all day or wants to watch, you know, sitcoms from morning till evening, that is a dedicated task. And there are good things coming from it if we have the eyes to see it. One of the ways to help our kids move into the achievement category, if we're focused on school subjects, is to actually draw from the place of expertise and enthusiasm your child already has. So if your child is really invested in sitcoms, having an academic theoretical conversation about sitcom theory, it just means you have to do research. I love to tell parents, PhD dissertations have been written on every possible topic, every permutation of every possible topic. There are PhD dissertations on Seinfeld, I guarantee it. There are PhD dissertations on fairy tales. There is no subject area that is beneath academic inquiry. And so if your child shows any interest in anything, there are ways to access that subject area for all the things you think they need to learn. And part of your task is to find those connections. That's your job. That's what you can do for them. And so instead of feeling like, oh, my child is just not a high achiever, and you put them in this role, and then you start sort of organizing your life around this low expectation, how about finding ways to affirm what might be invisible to that child? When Johanna first went to high school, my daughter is 27 now and traveling the world. She went to 2 classes a day at the local high school. And when she came home, the only thing she wanted to talk about was the dynamics between students and the teacher and the student. Sure, she was learning whatever the subject was, but that wasn't her area of fascination. Her area of fascination was interpersonal dynamics. Homeschool felt very small to her because she needed this big test tube of people, you know, a classroom of humans to observe and identify and define. Today at 27, do you know what she's interested in? Personality dynamics, life coaching, therapy, mindfulness, because all of her interest and energy has been on how people relate to each other. She's been a social worker and a college counselor for kids who dropped out of high school. She is totally matching the high achievement of her social networking IQ that showed up very early in life. So easy to miss because it looks like she's just into being social. Fortunately, it was pretty clear to me who she was, and it didn't disturb me at all. But it would be easy to miss. I just tend to be that kind of person, so I could see it at work. You want to keep room, space for expertise in the things you don't value in order to see your child blossom and imagine self in more categories than the couple they currently have. And it's also true in your marriage, or your partnership, or the main primary other person that's co-parenting with you. You have to give each other room. You know, it's possible that your spouse has a different vision of how homeschool should look than you. And it's okay for those two to not even be on the same page right now. One of the ways to get to a shared page is to make space for both pages. You know, let's say you're a woman and he's a man and you've been reading all of these like John Holt unschooly people, and he's over here with really happy memories of traditional education. Is there a way for both of those to coexist in your homeschool? Oh, mind blowing. Instead of it being about manipulating everybody into the same view, is there room to make space for multiple views, for differences in action, for valuing the desire to contribute to the vision of home education and not just see all difference as criticism? Is there room for difference? That would be one way to think about roles. Another little tidbit I wanted to share is there was a talk I listened to years ago by a somewhat, you know, parenting therapist expert kind of person. He had four kids, and that at that time, his kids were in college and late teens. And he was being asked about chores. And I took this comment so to heart. He said, as your kids get older in their teen years, hand down the chores to younger children. The temptation to benefit from the free labor of your more and more skilled older and older children sometimes lets the younger children off the hook. And it's not fair to those older kids because they need to be looking outward and using their time for the things that launch them out of the family, not for the things that help the parents. It isn't a teenager's job at 15, 16, 17 to babysit your kids. It's their job to go get a job, to be out in the world, navigating a time punch card, driving, showing up on time, being under another boss, figuring out what it feels like to have a paycheck they have to spend. So some of what we want to do when we're looking at roles is also recognizing when we sometimes rely on our children to fulfill jobs we're sick of doing. And we just sort of keep using them in ways that makes us feel good that maybe aren't in their best interests. So I share that with you as something to consider, something to mull in your heads. You know, especially when you have a big family, it's tempting to create a lot of little parents out of the oldest kids, but they didn't sign up for that. They didn't choose to have eight children. You did. It's not their job to raise the younger kids or to overly parent them. I mean, occasionally, sure, they can be in charge, but if so much is falling to them that they are limited in their ability to imagine a life for themselves as adults because they can't escape the role they're in, that's something to reconsider. So these are ideas about roles. I would say the fundamental theory that I just want to leave you with is this. You know your family is healthy when there is latitude for kids to imagine themselves in multiple ways. And so that nobody gets fixed, you know, oh, she's the youngest, she's the baby, she always gets what she wants. He's the middle child, he's really good always at keeping the peace. She's the oldest child, she's the high achiever. You know, not helpful. We have a joke in our family, because Noah is the oldest, that he absolutely defies all of the birth order stuff because he doesn't look like any of the firstborn descriptions I've ever heard. Meanwhile, Johanna embodied pretty much all the firstborn characteristics. And so we had a joke in our family that Johanna was the displaced firstborn. But you know, that fixed her in a role. And what's fascinating to me now is that Noah at 30 is the one who looks like the most traditional kid. He's living locally. He's got a great job. He has friends and people he goes out with. And he wants to be a dad like crazy. Meanwhile, Johanna, the, you know, firstborn lookalike, is off traveling the world for a second year, turning down master's programs and expanding her life and doesn't want to be married at all. Like, don't you think that's interesting? But they both have had some latitude to do both. And I think that's good. I think it's important. You don't want to box yourself in either. You want to give yourself permission to be in different seasons, to love school and then not love school, homeschool. I had a great conversation with Susan Weisbauer about that very thing. It's so important to pay attention to your want to, not just your have to, because that influences everything. We want to keep choosing, just like our kids get to keep choosing. And if you need to have a conversation with a spouse who has you kind of in a rigid role, now is the time. Go out for coffee and say, I want us to bust out of these roles. I want both of us to have freedom to not live up to each other's expectations. What would that look like? Make a big list, you know? Maybe somebody wants to be a marathon runner and they're worried about how much time that will take away from the family. And maybe the other one wants permission to just not be accountable all the time for whatever it is they've been criticized for. These are things that need to be talked about because the healthiest families can communicate about things that make everyone feel insecure. That's pretty much what health is. Being able to talk about the things that sort of make everybody else feel a little nervous.
That's it for today. I hope you found some ideas you can implement even this week. I'd love to hear from you. Follow me on Instagram at Julie Bravewriter, or you can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Bravewriter. In the meantime, live honestly, write bravely. I'm Julie Bogart from Bravewriter.